The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekend radio program that helps you sort through today's issues in a way that honors your Christian faith. I'm Don Crow. This week, as we close out the year 2017, we were reminded that we still live in a dangerous world with an ongoing threat from radical Islam. We'll look at an attack in Pakistan.
It would be significant anyway, but it is noted as the first attack by ISIS on a church in Pakistan.
And the failed attack in New York City.
The bomb went off prematurely. Had it not gone off in that way, it probably would have killed somewhere between 50 and 100 people. So I think we were very fortunate.
We'll also get a reminder of the work of God that is happening within the Muslim world, with harrowing testimony of a woman converted out of Islam.
I was just dumped like nothing on highway. I saw myself like a piece of trash at that time. Life was not worth living.
We have all this and more. Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in the nation's capital. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon locally on 105.1 FM, online at WAVA.com, and on your mobile device through the TuneIn radio app. 2017 comes to a close this coming week, and looking back, we are reminded that we are living through dynamic and dangerous times. One of the stories of the year behind us that did not receive adequate attention in our crowded news cycle was the defeat of ISIS. It was an enormous achievement. In 2014, the Islamic State controlled eastern Syria and a full third of Iraq. On December 10th, just a few short weeks ago, Iraqi Prime Minister al-Abadi celebrated the defeat of ISIS, establishing a new national holiday. The victory, of course, came with some heavy lifting from our men and women in uniform. And yet we are reminded that the broader threat of radical Islam remains very much with us. In the run-up to Christmas, a Christian church in Pakistan was targeted. To explain, we'll turn first to Luann Sabatia from 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. She was a guest on my program. This week, the area of great concern is the country and region of Pakistan. So take us there, if you would. What are some of the critical issues there right now?
Well, Don, 2 days ago, I believe almost on the front page of every or most major newspapers in the country, certainly in the Washington, D.C. region, were photographs and a headline, Suicide Attack on Church in Pakistan Darkens Christmas Celebrations. So why this is significant, not just it would be significant anyway, but it is noted as the first attack by ISIS on a church in Pakistan. And I believe it was a Baptist church, and 9 were killed, 50 wounded, and 7 are critical. So 2 attackers claimed by Islamic State affiliate used bombs and guns, and it was the Bethel Memorial Church. And so we're grateful that the loss of life was not more, but it represents a turning point. There's been a lot of discrimination and persecution of religious minorities, of which it's not only Christians, it's Hindus, Ahmadis, and Shia Muslims. But let me back up and just say, Pakistan is a country with a population of 189 million, and roughly 2 million or 2% of the population are Christians in Pakistan. And you may recall about a year ago, there was a pretty deadly attack on a park where there was an Easter celebration, and that was also targeting Christians. And let me back up and say we're all familiar with, or most of us, with Open Doors, and we refer to Open Doors a lot when we have these interviews. Open Doors every year looks around the world of all the countries, I think whatever, there are 187, and they list what they think are the top 50 countries that are the most egregious. Out of all the countries in the world, Pakistan is number 4 on their list. Mm. But what I want to say to you is because they have been an ally for many years up through the Cold War of the U.S. government, the State Department has even though our Commission on Religious Freedom has for 12 years recommended that they designate Pakistan a country of particular concern, our government has not done that yet. And what happens when you become a CPC, a country of particular concern, then the U.S. government can put more pressure on to stop the persecution and stop some of these ridiculous blasphemy laws. But if they are not a country of particular concern officially, there's very little our government can do. So today I'd like to say to your listeners that you can go on the State Department government website and you can send Secretary Tillerson a message up to, I think, 5,000 characters. It goes straight into his communications team saying that you're aware of Pakistan and please designate them a country of particular concern.
I think our listeners really do need to be encouraged and be confident that a few messages, a few letters, a few phone calls really do have far more impact than they may think.
Absolutely. And one other thing they can do, an amazing, she is Muslim, but an amazing diplomat and very strong supporter of Christians and religious freedoms. She's Pakistani, and her name is Farah Naz Ipsahani. She wrote a book that is extremely insightful called Purifying the Land of the Pure, Pakistan's Religious Minorities. So if someone wants to take a deeper dive about what Pakistan is doing and what's been their recent history, it's a fascinating book. But, yeah, again, what we want to do, Don, and we're so grateful to you at the Wilberforce Initiative for giving us this platform to share with your listeners, is I want to say to the listeners right now, when you see these atrocities, and they are happening, Don, in Egypt, in Pakistan, they continue to happen in Iraq, that is still so unsettled. We may have won the war officially against ISIS there, but just atrocities still occurring, and they are not at a good spot right now. When you see those headlines in your newspaper or hear it on CNN, I want you to try to think of individuals and their stories and those families and move beyond the headline and say, I can make a difference.
Of course, the threat that comes from the metastasizing of radical Islam is not limited to nations and regions distant from us. In fact, the fact that the Islamic State no longer has significant territory it could label as a caliphate could well make lone wolf-type attacks more common. We saw that earlier in the month, when New York saw an attempted terror attack that was too close for comfort. In the wake of that failed effort, Herb London of the New York-based London Policy Center joined my colleague Craig Roberts. They spoke on KFAX in San Francisco.
The timing of this, of course, is troubling. We're talking about an extremely busy time of the year. You've got holiday shoppers, people bustling back and forth to work. This attack, 7:30 in the morning in busy Midtown Manhattan subway corridor. Obviously, it was designed to have the maximum impact.
Well, the bomb went off prematurely. Had it not gone off in that way, it probably would have killed somewhere between 50 and 100 people. So I think we were very fortunate. But what it suggests is that this kind of terrorism is not going to go away. The vulnerability of the United States, the openness of our society, clearly suggests that we will be facing incidents of this kind in the future. And it's also true that the so-called radicalization is an ongoing process, in large part because ISIS and Al-Qaeda understand that they are in a war of ideas. This ideational war that we are engaged in is a war that's going to go on for a long time. And we've got to convince many young people that there is no virgin waiting for you in paradise. And in fact, what will happen is you're going to be put in a black box and buried 6 feet under the ground. There is no future for you. We've got to give people a future, but they do not have one with ISIS, notwithstanding all of the claims about romance and concubines and rifles. So I do think that it's imperative we start to understand this is not only a war being fought in Mosul and in Raqqa. It's a war being fought in our cities, in our states, and of course in the minds of young people across the globe.
This immigrant, as we are learning, was a so-called chain immigrant here on a F-43 visa. He's been stateside for about 6 years now, living in Brooklyn. And I guess part of the problem here is that some of these newer immigrants, and I don't know that necessarily Bangladesh is at the top of a terrorist-producing country list, but regardless, it sounds like some of these newer immigrants are having a difficult time integrating into American culture and society.
Well, you know, again, in the case of the Bangladeshis, they represent half of the taxi drivers in New York. So many of them have obviously integrated into the society. What is interesting is that the mother of this young man, who came to the United States under a lottery, by the way, in which there wasn't any betting at all, that brings her son here, largely through chain immigration, as you pointed out. His goal is to kill Americans. And there's virtually no vetting that occurs in his case because of family unification practices. Now, this is bizarre. This is utterly bizarre. And if we're going to change anything, we must change an immigration policy that makes it easy, or relatively easy, for people of this variety to enter the United States and to cause murder and mayhem.
It would seem to me, Herb, in a post-9/11 environment, that we've missed taking to heart some important lessons. I mean, why is it even still we feel compelled to engage in the so-called lottery? I mean, I realize there's a vetting process after that, but even the terminology seems to have so much of at risk or at chance inherent to it. Shouldn't we as a nation be far more selective in terms of the people that we are inviting and what countries they're coming from?
I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, if there was one reason why Donald Trump was elected president of the United States last year, it's because Donald Trump understood the immigration issue on a visceral level, on a level that most Americans understand. These are not elitists. The elitists marching up and down K Street, they don't get it. But the average guy saying, you know what, the president of the United States has a responsibility to maintain order and tranquility. That's his job. If he is not doing it, something is wrong. And if immigration policy stands in the way of maintaining the kind of national security we deserve and need, then it seems to me we've got to change presidents. And I think that's what happened.
Clearly, this is going to call for, I hope, another review of our immigration policy, although already I've heard some of the Democrats suggesting, well, maybe we can look at this. Maybe we need to give some consideration to the F-43 visa program. But we have to be careful because we want to make sure that we're giving everybody a fair shake.
Well, this whole notion of giving people a fair shake is absurd. Immigration policy is designed to benefit the United States. The policy is not designed to change the character of the world. We cannot do that. All we can say is we want an immigration policy that would invite people to this country who care about America. Teddy Roosevelt once used the expression Americanization. And what he meant by that is, I want people to come to the United States, said the president, when they care about the United States, they embrace our customs, they understand our Constitution, they want to be part of the American society, and they speak our language. If those are the people that want to come here, I'm all in favor, he said. And so am I.
Coming up,
I was just dumped like nothing on highway. I saw myself like a piece of trash at that time. Life was not worth living.
Called Out of Islam to Life in Christ. Stay with us. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. To hear this show again in its entirety, go to ChristianOutlook.com. While you're there, take just a few minutes and subscribe to our podcast. We do well to watch and watch closely the various threats from radical Islam, threats that we see in our own country and around the world. We'll continue to cover those stories here on The Christian Outlook. But we also do well to give attention to the growing number of converts to Christianity coming out of Islam. Işık Abla grew up in Turkey and escaped to America with quite a story to tell. She was a guest of Frank Sontag on KKLA in Los Angeles.
We want to spend a lot of time talking about what happened. So you came to America. How old were you?
I was 25 years old.
And you left to get away from your abusive husband. You came to our country, and yet you still were?
I was still a Muslim. But my life just started getting bad to worse at that time. So it was year 2000. My high and drunk husband at that time, I had a daughter, 2.5, 3 years old. He dumped me on highway when he was high and drunk. I wanted to drive the car, and he didn't want me to drive. He stopped the car and kicked me out. And that night, my journey started with Jesus. Because a Christian lady stopped on highway from Miami to Homestead, very dark road, and she gave me a ride. I only saw the car, and I said, in my mind, praying like Muslim way, I prayed that it's a woman, because if it's a man, New Year night, he's going to rape me, kill me, or rob me. And it was a woman. It was a Christian woman. I got inside the car. She started telling me God had amazing plans for my life.
Now, when she shared that with you, being a woman that believed in the Quran, and I mean, you had a lot of preconceived notions about Christians up
until
that point.
Sure, sure. They were infidels. They were just blaspheming through God, Allah.
So you're in this car with this woman. She shares she's a Christian. Were you angry at her? Did you have any of those thoughts? Or you were just so at the end of yourself?
I was very at the end of myself. I wasn't believing anything she was saying, but I was very numb because of my pain at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was thinking, because I was just dumped like nothing on highway. I saw myself like piece of trash at that time. Life was not worth living. And here this woman is quoting from Jeremiah 29:11 and telling me, God has plans for your life. You are so young and beautiful, and I was 28 at that time, and I was feeling like I was 80-something years old. And I didn't believe that God had plans for me. I believed that God hated me, because I was a failure, I was a loser. So she took me to a home, another lady's home, who told me, my home is your home, later on that night. And I picked up my daughter next day with police escort and started living with that lady. And found a job at a Christian company. Come on.
Wow.
and I said to myself, Christians are everywhere. Of course, we see in the Muslim, we were seeing, and they still see America as a Christian country. So, and I said, Christians are everywhere. I started working, and I had this crazy boss who was in love with Jesus. And every day he was talking about Jesus, and I am like, this man is absolutely insane. And he was super nice. He was not a perfect guy. He was super nice Christian, which is sometimes hard to find, with his imperfections. And every time I told him, you are so nice, he told me, no, I am a jerk. The only person is nice in me is Jesus Christ. And I said, I don't want to hear this, Jesus. So I started going to Bible study at work. That was a company that they built Bible websites, imagine, 17 years ago. And I was doing computer work for them. And then through those Bible studies, I started really liking Jesus and seeing Jesus in a different way.
Wow. Ishik Abla is my guest. Before we talk about any further, the question that comes up, did you renounce Islam? Or were you just kind of in the state of searching, lost? I mean, to go to a Bible study and being a Muslim, those two worlds kind of collide.
Sure. I was just going to those Bible studies at the beginning to please my boss, secure my job. Tell you the truth, before I went to the Bible study, I prayed to Allah. And I said, Allah, those are infidels. They're going to go to hell. And they deserve death. But I am going there because I am a single mother now, and I need this job. But it didn't work that way. I started falling in love with Jesus every single day in those Bible studies.
Was there a moment when you surrendered to him?
It was very difficult. Mm-hmm. So I started seeing the glimpse of hope at the end of the tunnel. But because I couldn't make the decision, I became more miserable. And one morning I woke up, and there was this suicide thought in my mind. Life is not worth living. Life is not worth living. And I took my daughter to daycare. I went to work, and I started planning my suicide. And I said, I want to do something like an accident so my daughter never, inherit that kind of legacy from me, mm-hmm. that her mother committed suicide. And I was planning an accident. And I ran to the restroom at workplace and just pour out my anguish. And I didn't know at the time which God I was talking to, because I always prayed in Arabic. But first time I was speaking like this, talking to a person and saying, God, why you hate me? Why you forsaking me? Why you abandoning me? And just crying, like almost having the closure with him. And then I cleaned my face. I went to my seat and my boss called me to his office. That crazy boss of mine said, please have a seat. Please close the door and have a seat. And I'm waiting for him to fire me because my mind was always thinking negative outcome.
Sure.
And he said, I'm going to tell you something. I have never done this before, but I have to be obedient. My Lord Jesus just told me he knows your plans. He wants me to tell you. You are not forsaken nor abandoned. When you were a little girl, he was by your side. When you were molested, he was by your side. When you were raped, he was by your side. When you were beaten up like a dog on the floor, he was by your side. He was praying and interceding for you that one day you would turn to him. So he wants me to ask you right now, would you receive him as your Lord and Savior? And I didn't think a second, Frank. I just fell to the ground on my face and I just started saying yes. Yes. Yes, I knew Jesus was real because I had an encounter with him at that moment. Because revelation is presence of God. And he was in that room. I cannot explain it, but it wasn't intangible. He was tangible. He was there. And I knew he was real. And I couldn't resist his presence. And that was it. There was no big sinner's prayer said or no big altar's call made, but just yes. I was just saying yes. And then I felt like this tons of weight lifted off my shoulders. I felt like grass looked greener and sky looked blue, and I wanted to run on the streets, that jihadist woman. I wanted to run and kiss and hug everybody. I look like this drunk person in a bar. All the drinks are on me. I was like, this is crazy. I am filled with joy.
And freedom.
And freedom. Complete freedom. That's a big topic of my programs right now. Freedom. He set me free.
Coming up.
This is what I want to tell my fellow caregivers. They're going to do stuff that's going to absolutely drive us up the wall sometimes. They're not doing it to us. They're just doing it. And we don't have to take everything so personally.
Help and hope for primary caregivers. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. I sincerely hope that your Christmas celebration last week was blessed and that the new year is filled with many blessings for you and yours. But I am well aware that there are many of you who carry burdens hard to bear. Some of you are devoted to caring for someone who is housebound. Some listeners may be housebound themselves. So whether it be you directly or someone in your world, our next guest is a rich resource. Peter Rosenberger is the founder of the ministry Standing with Hope, and he's the author of the book Hope for the Caregiver. Peter was a guest of Craig Roberts on KFAX in San Francisco.
Peter, as you know from your own experience, this can be physically, mentally, emotionally, relationally, oftentimes financially draining, to the point where a lot of people say, hope? I don't see any way out.
Well, there's several things. Hope for the Caregiver, and that's the name of my new book, is not hearts and rainbows and unicorns. It is the conviction that we as caregivers can live a calmer, healthier, and even more joyful life, even while dealing with grim realities. Now, everything in Scripture tells me that that's the case for us in our Christian walk. Jesus said, don't let your hearts be troubled. I'm going to prepare a place for you. That's our hope. Our hope is not in eliminating all the unpleasant things of this earth. That is not our hope. That is beyond my pay grade. Look down at your hands. If you don't see nail prints, this ain't yours to fix. Mm. You know, our hope is knowing that God has spared us as believers from something far worse than multiple amputations and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and 30 years worth of chronic pain. He spared us from something far greater than that. So when we're looking at somebody who we can't reach anymore because they're impaired through pharmaceuticals or dementia or whatever, We can love them tapped in because we're tapped into the inexhaustible love of God through Christ. This is what I want to tell my fellow caregivers. They're going to do stuff that's going to absolutely drive us up the wall sometimes. They're not doing it to us. They're just doing it. And we don't have to take everything so personally. They don't want to be sick. They don't want to deal with dementia. They don't want to deal with chronic pain. They don't want to be doing all this stuff. We just happen to be the closest person to them. You know, what is it Mother Teresa once said? You know, thank you, Lord Jesus, for the privilege of serving you in your many horrible disguises. Mm. And you know, you can be all bent out of shape about this. But my goal for caregivers is that when we do stand at a grave, and one day, most likely we will, and that's the goal, by the way, is that for a caregiver to stand in the grave, not be in the grave first. And that's a hard thing to say, but that's the reality. But that we stand there without clenched fists, without fists that are clenched at our loved one, at families and friends that didn't maybe help the way we wanted them to, at ourselves for what we could have, would have, should have done, or even at God, that we can learn to live peacefully with these things. Even if your loved one is not dealing with all this stuff, you're not living a trouble-free life. Everybody's got something going on.
Is part of this, Peter, sort of the natural flesh inclination to push back against this aspect of the reality of life? Is it helpful for the caregiver to be reminded of that, or are we just kind of pushing back against the reality of the grave and maybe our own sense of mortality?
Well, I think what happens is we are screaming out for relief. And so we rush to things like, you know, euthanizing, things like that, and so forth. We're just screaming out for relief. You learn to accept that maybe relief is not the thing that we're supposed to be seeking so much as learning to trust God in this. And we place our scared hand into his scarred hand and learn to say, okay, well, how do I deal with this today? See, nobody can do this for a lifetime, Craig. But anybody can do it for 24 hours.
So instead of focusing on our suffering, focus instead on our serving.
Well, exactly. And focus on what God is doing in the midst of these things. You know, you go back and look at Solzhenitsyn after he got out of the Russian prison, and he said, you know, bless you, prison, for the change you've made in my life. Corrie ten Boom. I could just go down the list of people, Viktor Frankl and all these other people, Nelson Mandela. He went into prison almost as a terrorist and came out a statesman. And there's a point where we walk through this suffering, we walk through these bleak things, but if we are willing to go inward and to be changed in a healthy direction through this thing, we find that we can experience a quality of life that we thought was unattainable. There's beauty everywhere. There's excitement everywhere. There's joy everywhere. But sometimes we allow these things to obfuscate our view because this does affect us, like you said, our health, our emotions, our lifestyle, our profession, our money. Everything about this is affected, but is that necessarily a bad thing, and is it causing us to act like jerks? It's all about stewardship. How can I be the best steward for my wife? How can I be the best steward for me? What is the best choice for the unit? And as your godfather found out, that sometimes he had to get away, and he has to recognize that it's more important for him to have moments of respite and healthiness, and he's just going to have to not answer the phone so that he can be a healthy person. She needs him healthy. And people that are in pain or people that are diseased or whatever, impaired, they can't always see that. And so it's up to the caregiver to make those unilateral decisions without guilt, recognizing that they're loving them better when they're becoming healthier as an individual.
For the complete conversation between Craig Roberts and Peter Rosenberger, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, a philosopher's lament for his sweet wife.
Very tragically, Becky knows what she has lost. She will say things like, I used to be so smart, and why did God do this to me?
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. A number of you may well be familiar with the name Douglas Grotius. He's an accomplished Christian author, an apologist who has been a professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary for 25 years now. You might recognize his name from our show, as he's been a guest on our program before. A few years ago, he would have been surprised if you told him that he'd be a primary caregiver for his wife. His latest book is a volume he didn't think he'd write. A book that, even in the midst of his trial, he didn't really want to write. The title of that volume, Walking Through Twilight, A Wife's Illness, A Philosopher's Lament. Grotius was a guest of Eric Metaxas.
This book, you described what Becky has, but it's sort of like early onset Alzheimer's, but it's not. Is that right?
Yes and no. It's early onset dementia. Becky was diagnosed when she was 59. Now, when I tell people my wife has dementia, they often say, with concern, does she recognize you? And I say, she always recognizes me because she has primary progressive aphasia, not Alzheimer's.
Right.
So at this point, she can understand quite a bit, but she can say very little. And she also has a condition called apraxia, which means she simply doesn't know how to accomplish things. She doesn't know how to make coffee. She can't use the telephone. She doesn't know so many things that you have to assist her. And we have a live-in caregiver, and we have other people coming in. And, of course, I help her and care for her.
I just want to thank you for taking the time to process this very difficult experience the way you have, because I think this is the kind of thing that can help people that are struggling with similar things.
Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted to do. In fact, this was a book I did not want to write, but a number of people, including editors and friends, encouraged me to do so. And I'm an incorrigible writer. I write pretty much about everything I care about. And so I found myself writing about our experiences even before I had a book contract. And then I realized that this should be a book. So I went with my longtime publisher, InterVarsity, and forged the book I never wanted to write, but which I had to write.
Part of what makes the story difficult and all the more poignant is that Becky was extraordinarily talented as a thinker and as a writer, and she edited all of your previous books. And now, of course, as you say, she can't use a telephone or make coffee. So it's that kind of a journey from being exquisitely verbal to struggling so much that makes it all the more difficult.
That's true. And throughout the book, I have what I call interludes, and those are short accounts of things that happen with Becky. And one of them is called the Mensa card. I was looking in my desk, and I uncovered Becky's old Mensa card that was dated 1994.
Now, not everybody knows what Mensa is.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a what they call a high intelligence society. So you have to have a genius level IQ to join Mensa. And I encouraged Becky to do it to add to her resume as she was getting published and giving speaking engagements. She was really reluctant to do it. But I had not thought of that for a while. And at first I saw it and I put it in the category of things no longer needed for Becky, and that's a pretty broad category now. But then, of course, the poignancy of it hit me. This once brilliant woman could probably not even recognize this as a Mensa card. And of course, I will not show it to her. So it is all the more horrible because Becky encouraged me to write my first book and she edited it. And over the years, we developed a very close, very productive relationship of my writing and her editing. Becky herself was a writer. She wrote two books, Good News for Women and Women Caught in the Conflict. She also co-edited an academic book called Rediscovering Biblical Equality. Now, very tragically, Becky knows what she has lost. She will say things like, I used to be so smart, and why did God do this to me? And those are deeply distressing and painful comments, and I'm often at a loss how to respond to her except to say, God used you. And God is continuing to use your books. Now, when I considered writing the book, I needed to get Becky's permission. And I said, you have ministered to people previously through your strengths, through your writing abilities, your intelligence. And if you let me write this book, you can minister to people through your weakness. And it clicked with her. And I assured her I would tell no family secrets. I would be discreet. But the book was designed to help people suffer well, suffer wisely, which is a neglected skill in our society. In fact, we're supposed to not suffer at all. And if we feel lament or mourning, the typical American response is to get over it and move on. But that doesn't do justice to love.
It strikes me that you have a situation where it forces you to see what is always true. In other words, we are always living with death. We're always living in a world that's broken and sinful. But we live in a world now where people want to ignore that. They don't want to think about these things. They don't want to think about suffering or suffering well or dying well. God calls us to die and to suffer. And an illness like this is a long death and involves a lot of suffering. And you're staring at reality is what you're staring at. It's just that most people can avoid it more successfully.
That's true. And with the development of medical technologies and affluence in America and the West in general, we can often defer death. And then we have this general tendency, which can be quite good, of American optimism and entrepreneurship and boosterism. Let's find the good. Let's accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and so on. But there are cases where that is impossible. And so you have to learn these skills of lament. And lament is a deeply human and biblical category of mourning the loss of a true good. And as I said earlier, it is appropriate. It's right in many situations, not merely at funerals, but as one walks through life or staggers through life with very heavy burdens. And if you repress it, in fact, that can make your soul suffer even more. And it's sadly common. The people that suffer deep losses will take refuge in poison, addictions, obsessions, or even end their lives. So suffering skillfully as a Christian is part of virtue and love.
Coming up,
in the midst of that crucible, I could find meaning.
More of the conversation between Doug Groteis and Eric Metaxas. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment for the final segment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. As we learn today about the crucial role of primary caregivers, and as we wrestle with the story of Doug Groteis as he loves and ministers to his wife, we recognize, yes, that Christ is our great help in time of need. But even if secondhand, we recognize that we understand Christianity itself in a much more profound way as a result of walking with someone through the what can be very long valley of the shadow of death. Let's return for a few more minutes of Eric Metaxas and Doug Groteis.
Sometimes people say that suffering forces them closer to God, that they feel him in a way that they didn't when everything was great. I don't know if that's been your experience, but...
In a sense, yes, because you have to draw on resources that you perhaps never drew on before. And one thing that I come back to repeatedly is the idea of finding meaning, even in the midst of abysmal, overwhelming situations. When Becky was in the psychiatric unit for 5 weeks, I would visit her as much as possible. I would pray that I could find some way to bless people, some way to show love, to, as I put it, smelt meaning out of suffering. And I would be there, of course, for her, for Becky. But she was not all that communicative often when I was there. So she might be eating, and I would look around the room and try to find someone that I could show love to, someone who maybe would like to hear my voice or would tell me how to pray for them. So in the midst of that crucible, I could find meaning. And the whole idea of a crucible is to be more like Christ, who suffered on the cross for us and cried out in desperation, my God, why have you forsaken me? Quoting Psalm 22:1. And there's no religion, no philosophy in the world that says that the suffering of the greatest person who ever existed is the key to the redemption of the universe. Because in that suffering on the cross and through that death, our sins were forgiven, atoned for. And following that gruesome death, there's a resurrection and an ascension. And Christ is at the right hand of the Father, interceding for us. And he's with us. In the book, I have a chapter called My Escape into Meaning. And I try to draw a distinction between deserting your post and escaping into legitimate enjoyment. Mm. And I deeply love jazz, and I like to take my friends to our local jazz venue, which I think is one of the best in the country, Dazzle. And when I'm there seeing Pat Martino or Cyrus Chestnut or someone, and showing my friends what's so great about jazz, there's a deep joy. And there's an escape from the other concerns, at least for an hour or two. And that's a gift from God.
That wraps up this edition of The Christian Outlook. Thanks for joining us. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. For executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Chanda Chisala, I'm Don Crow, wishing you the happiest of New Year's and God's richest blessings in the year ahead.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.